On this occasion, our theme sounds remarkably spiritual, which is totally appropriate, given that sitting opposite me in my monk cell is Adjunct Professor Frank Brennan, SJAO. Now, the reason that Frank thinks he's here is because we decided, as the year was coming to an end, to have long chats with tribal elders to look at the body politic and the state of the national psyche. And yes, Frank and I, Frank being my favourite Jesuit, Frank and I will get round to that in due course. But first of all, I want to talk briefly about conspiracy theories. I don't hold with them. I really don't. I tend to think that there was a lone gunman in Dallas. I find it incredibly hard to take seriously the argument that George W. Bush and his cohorts organised 9/11 because they are, after all, the gang that couldn't shoot straight, and bringing up the greatest act of treason in human history does seem a bit beyond their level of competence. However, there is clearly a Jesuit conspiracy. I mean, all of a sudden, the Jesuits are taking over the entire planet. They seize the Vatican. And everywhere I look in Australian politics, there's either a Jesuit or someone of Jesuit education in a powerful and influential place. Now, Frank, I know very little about the Jesuits. I remember Simon Winchester explaining to me in a long chat we had about the San Franciscan earthquake that for some miraculous or strange reason, Jesuits were the great seismologists and volcanologists and knew more about earthquakes than anybody. And I do remember vaguely that there was someone called the Black Pope. But beyond that, it's all very, very peculiar. So will you now fess up? Who are you, folks? How did the Jesuits start?
Well, I can start by assuring you there's no conspiracy, Philip. Anyone who knows the Jesuits from within would know that we're highly disorganized and highly individualized. But having said that, yeah, founded really as part of the Counter-Reformation, and we were seen to be intelligent, pastorally engaged, and available to go to what we'll call the frontiers. And so the idea was we wouldn't be confined to dioceses. Generally, we wouldn't be promoted to be bishops or archbishops or cardinals or whatever. We could go wherever. So someone like Francis Xavier could literally be sent to the other end of the earth. So engaged with the sciences, engaged with the arts, engaged with people in their everyday lives, and available to go anywhere.
And across the political spectrum, I would have thought.
True. I mean, if you look at the contemporary context, you have to admit that, yes, there's a preponderance of Jesuit-educated alumni who are there on the conservative side of the political agenda in Australia. But I think that more follows class and family interest rather than the particular teachings. And what you have is that, of course, Irish Jesuits who came to Australia were engaged in the great enterprise in which they were very successful, in helping particularly the Irish Catholics, but also other immigrant Catholics, to make their way up. So that you've ended up with, yes, a large preponderance of those who are now in the Liberal and National parties. And Bill Shorten, the leader of the opposition, is the only leading member of the Labor Party from Jesuit ranks.
The Black Pope.
Black Pope, the idea there was that what you had was, because Ignatius Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits, said, we want to be of universal service to the Pope, he went and said, we're here to serve you and not just particular dioceses. And because the Pope always dressed in white, which was a derivative of the Dominican habit, for which we have to forgive him, the Pope, the Jesuit leader, dressed just in a plain black cassock, was always known as the Black Pope. Was always
said, wonderfully sinister.
Indeed, and was always thought that, of course, a Jesuit could never be Pope. In fact, I even had a canon law teacher who told me it wasn't possible. But who knows? Here we have Pope Francis.
Okay, how did you get recruited? Did the Jesuits go out looking for the best and brightest?
No, I was at university in Queensland in the early 70s. I remember Gough Whitlam once saying to me, how is it that there are so many social activists who came out of Queensland in those years? I said, well, it was simple, Gough. We had something to react to. His name was Sir J. Bielke Peterson. I was studying law and politics at that time in the early 70s. I was interested in becoming a priest, but I didn't quite know what I'd do. And as I looked around, the Jesuits at that stage were starting to emphasise the strong connection between Christian faith and social justice. Well, guess what? I thought, bingo, that's the connection that I've been looking for.
Well, I know you, of course, as Bolshie Brennan.
Yeah.
You know, the incredibly left-wing. Now, Frank, have you ever had profound religious doubts?
I've never had religious doubts. I must say, I mean, some might think it folly, but I've always been pretty blessed. I think that my basic religious framework has been pretty coherent. I've had doubts about the wisdom and the coherence of the Holy Roman Catholic Church, and I've had doubts about where we as Jesuits are going, and I've had doubts at times about, you know, what does a life of living the religious vows mean in a contemporary context. But in terms of the faith journey story, no, it's basically sat with me pretty well through my life in terms of dealing with questions of suffering, questions of mortality, questions of professing great ideals, but at the same time acknowledging human foibles, human sinfulness. The whole package for me has continued to resonate.
Given that Jesuits swear allegiance to the White Pope, how do you feel about the incumbent?
Well, I feel very happy about the incumbent, Philip. I was talking down in Launceston the other day on Pope Francis and social justice, and something really came home to me. I was ordained a priest in 1985. The two previous popes were John Paul II and then Benedict. Now, I think it's not a disservice to them to say they had what I'd call something the theology of the remnant, that basically we're on about orthodoxy, and there are all these very detailed papal teachings, and the question was who signed up and who didn't. Whereas this fella, he's not into the remnant, he's into what I call the leaven, the theology of the leaven. We're about engagement in the world, and it's about trying to increase the quotient in the world of faith, hope and love.
When will they slip him a Mickey? I mean, it's not uncommon for popes to be prematurely retired.
Well, my great mate Paul Bongiorno there at Channel 10, the very moment Francis was elected, I got a text from him saying, I hope he's got a good food taster. Well, it would seem that the food taster at St Martha's to date has worked pretty well. Maybe he's thought, well, if he's eating the same food as the troops, he'll be able to survive.
But he is, in fact, taking on the Vatican bureaucrats, the apparatchiks, pretty energetically, isn't he?
Well, he is, but I think more to the point, what he's doing very deliberately is he's getting out there and just engaging with the world. I mean, what he's daring to profess is, look, we think we've got some good news, not just for those who are signed up Romans, and not just for those who solidly follow every papal decree. And basically, he's happy to engage. And so he's leaving a lot of the internal stuff to be worked through with talented appointments that he's making, but he sees his task as being able to relate.
And he's also taking the matters of human sexuality off the front burner and suggesting that there's been an unhealthy emphasis on them.
Well, he is, and that's long overdue. As you know, I've had a long time line on this, that basically Catholic clergy shouldn't be talking publicly any more about sex than their married confreres do in other churches, in that sexuality is such a complex phenomenon that to have celibates out there all the time professing to give all the detailed answers, I just don't think works. And that's even before we get to deal with the sexual abuse crisis. And that's had to teach, I think, the church institutionally a great new humility.
We'll circle back to that later. The Jesuits seem to have got through this era relatively unscathed, and that's...
Relatively unscathed, but there have been problems, particularly with a couple of the provinces of Jesuits in the United States. I mean, wherever you've had religious who have been involved with vulnerable children, particularly in remote places, say, for example, remote schools in Alaska or whatever, inevitably there will have been problems in the past.
You and I seem to be just about the only people in Australia that quite like Kevin Rudd.
And I still count him a mate.
And Kevin told me that you were, in fact, incredibly influential in him coming out with a change of attitude to homosexuality. You didn't go so far as to suggest that gay marriage was okay, but Kevin was so astonished by the figures on youth suicide by closeted young men that he felt something had to change.
Hmm. Kevin and I, over the years, particularly the years he was in banishment, yes, we used to have long late-night walks around the lake there in Canberra, or early morning walks, or catches up at the Hyatt or whatever, and we discussed all manner of things. What has always been important to me is to draw a distinction between internal theological discussion about what you think is the nature of sacramental marriage over against questions about the social institution of marriage within a very pluralistic society. The other thing that's been very important, Philip, is we all know people who are homosexual, who are people who are very loving, very forgiving. They live faithful, loving lives together. And basically, the church teaching on this sort of thing has been well out of kilter for a very long time.
It's anomalous, I think, that there are some ex-Anglicans who've been embraced by the Catholic Church over the years who are married within the church.
Sure, it's ludicrous. And, you know, the celibacy thing for the diocesan clergy is simply a rule of discipline. It's been there for half the life of the church, but it's very clear now that change has to come.
Will it happen in, you're quite a young fellow, will it happen in your lifetime, Bolshie Brennan, SJAO?
I don't know. I mean, these things take a lot of work internally, but then when they come, they'll come very suddenly, and I'm very fortified at the moment that Francis is out there saying the right things and engaging. I mean, the other big issue is in terms of women in the church. Now, where he's got a major difficulty there is that his predecessors tried to lock down the theology and to lock down the canon law, even to try and stop us talking about these matters. So I think there's still a lot of very detailed work that has to be done.
Imagine the future for Roman Catholicism, and paint a picture of what it could look like, or even should look like, in a decade.
Well, what it should look like, I mean, one of the highlights for me, I'm on the National Board of St. Vincent's Health. We're the largest Catholic health provider in the country. Every month I sit around a table with some of the most competent Catholic lay people in the country. And what is delightful is to see, I mean, the works not only of mercy and compassion, but also of excellence, which are performed in terms of research and in terms of outreach to the poor and marginalised and in terms of outstanding medical assistance. Now, that sort of thing can be replicated readily, where what you've got is the church which is no longer so clerical and hierarchical. I mean, I was there at the installation of our new Archbishop in Canberra yesterday, and it always is difficult for us when we see all of these elderly fellows, most with grey hair, all in these white chasubles up the front, and hardly a woman in sight. Now, that's got to move on, but where it has moved on already is in terms of the delivery of health, welfare and education. Now, what we've got to do in the church is, in the next decade, see that more replicated on our sanctuaries and see it replicated in our pews.
I have to say that I found both St. Vinny's and the Mater very kind to ageing atheists.
Indeed. In fact, we're particularly welcome of ageing atheists. Our mutual friend, the good Senator Susan Ryan, who is now a human rights commissioner for all manner of things, I don't think she'd mind my saying on air that she recently went in St. Vincent's, said that she'd gone in there and got very good treatment, even though the Human Rights Commission had been espousing rights for gays and lesbians. I said, Susan, we could put a little star there on your bed and we'd give you even better attention because of your indulgence.
When I moved from the Catholics to the Jews and went to Walper for rehab, I found that Cardinal Pell had also gone to Walper for his rehab when after he had his hip done.
Indeed.
I found that perplexing.
Oh, no, they give only the best. I know when my father had a break of his leg, he went to Walper, and one of the wonderful stories he told me was there were two Aboriginal nursing aides there, and when they found out he'd written a key judgment in Mabo, he was given just the most superb attention.
Okay, let's now turn to, as I promised, to the body politic and the national psyche. Interesting moment in our history.
Well, it is. I mean, as our old mate Keating said, when the government changes, the country changes, Philip. And I think we're in a very difficult phase. Basically, to be very blunt and non-partisan about it, given that the Labor Party tore itself apart, I think that what we then got was a change of government, probably 3 years before the new government was ready, in terms of having done the hard thinking on policy and in terms of having done the rejuvenation. So I think we've all got a price to pay as we wrestle with this moment, as we try and come to terms with a new government, which has a lot of work to do.
Many of us are perplexed by the fact that a Prime Minister who does loudly profess his religious beliefs and affiliations can be so hard-hearted on the refugee issue.
Mm. It's a very tough issue, and it's one where I think that the intersection between personal compassion...
You've got your diplomatic face on.
Oh, no. Sorry. Well, I'll crank it up a bit more. In fact, I'm going to be a bit naughty, Philip. I did a strong interview on this the other night for AM, and it wasn't even put to air. And in fact, they ran a story instead on the effect of horse manure in national parks. And I thought, well, something's amiss here. So let me state very stringently what needs to be done. Basically, what we're dealing with is, yes, both sides of politics in Australia say we want to stop the boats. It's only the minor parties who are interested in the compassionate Christian message being enunciated in policy. That being the case, the question that confronts all of us is a Liberal National Party government, which is there trying to do something tougher to stop the boats. How can that be more ethically rendered possible? Now, it's clear, Abbott is not going to pick up the parable of the Good Samaritan and apply it to our national borders. He's made that very clear. But what must be essential is, if we're going to be stopping people, we've got to do it in a way which our parliament approves. What Rudd announced in July, and what I was critical of, these PNG and Nauru arrangements, which I think are not sufficiently coherent in the detail which is there. It's never been to Parliament. Now, I think the matter should go to Parliament and it should be debated there. And where we've had a situation where people turned up on boats, as Tony Burke, the Minister, said at the time, they were on boats even before the announcement was made that they would never be allowed to settle in Australia. Now, I think that's just unfair. Those things have to be rectified by the Parliament, and if we do succeed in stopping the boats, then the real national conversation, and this is where Abbott's and our compassion has to come into play, it has to be, all right, we've secured the borders, we've now got an orderly migration program, but we do have a responsibility to do more to assist those who are genuine asylum seekers in this part of the world. And we've got to do more to assist Indonesia and Malaysia.
You and I have been concerned with this issue forever.
Forever. And we've been confronted
prior to Tampa.
Yes. And we've been confronted with the hypocrisy of the Labor Party during Tampa. And we've been confronted with the hypocrisy of the Liberal National Party during Gillard's Malaysia solution. And so what we've got is a perfect storm in terms of the national politics. And that's why it's necessary that it come back to Parliament. There be a bipartisan approach. There be a decision about the tough measures that are going to be taken to stop the boats. But then what's going to be the compassion quotient which Australia delivers, because we want to be something more than just mean and nasty.
It's fascinating to me that a nation which constantly proclaims its tolerance, and I remember going around Australia on the Chogham Committee to see how we might celebrate the Centenary of Federation, and everyone everywhere kept saying tolerant, tolerant, tolerant. I was unconvinced because I had vivid memories of the White Australia policy, which, as you know, lasted far longer than apartheid and was a sort of ethnic cleansing in advance. So when suddenly we had the One Nation phenomenon and it became quite obvious that we could be rabidly racist, I simply thought, well, business as usual. But I am still astonished at the way it's been so easy to herd public opinion into a very narrow place by manipulating the fear of boat people.
Mm. Could I, before we come to the fear, just say something perhaps a little controversial about the White Australia policy? The White Australia policy had at least this upside. It was, putting aside our treatment of Indigenous Australians, which we could discuss at length, but putting that aside, what it did have as an advantage was that anybody who lived here, who was welcomed here, was assured the right to work, or at least an adequate welfare social net.
I'm aware that there was a dimension of protecting living standards.
But now what we've done of late on both sides of politics, in terms of boat people, particularly those in the community, we've said to them, you won't have the right to work. And we said, we won't give you adequate welfare assistance. That's the first time we've ever done that in Australia. We're becoming un-Australian in the way we've treated them. The other thing, and the great Barney Cooney, you might remember Barney, a good Labor lawyer who was in the Senate for years, you share an office with Gerry Hand, but was very critical of Gerry Hand on the left of the ALP, when he, with Keating, instituted the mandatory detention of asylum seekers. And Barney Cooney nailed his flag to the mast of the lawyer and said, in Australia, we don't lock people up without a court process. Now, we've done that constantly for boat people now, and guess what? Now we do it for bikies, now we do it for sex offenders, and people are asking, where's it going to stop? And in my own home state of Queensland, 30 years after all the J.B. Elkey-Peterson stuff on Law and Order, we've got a repeat of it with Campbell Newman. Why? Once again, we have forfeited basic Australian values, first for boat people, but then it starts to emulate elsewhere. Having said that, Philip, coming to the fear point. The fear is there, but in conjunction with the fear, there are a lot of decent Australians who I meet who say, look, we know we can only take so many thousands a year. Talk about whether it be 10, 20, 30 or 50,000, but basically can we set up a system where there's some routine to this, where government controls it and not people smugglers? Now those people I don't think are motivated just by fear, but their concerns definitely mesh with those who are motivated by fear.
Aboriginal issues. I haven't heard Keating attack you yet.
I presume it'll come in episode 4.
Well, I suspect it might, because you and Paul had a major falling out over Indigenous issues.
We did, but it was after he was Prime Minister, Philip. As you know, look, he negotiated the Native Title Act in 93 and did an absolutely magnificent job. And it is one of the enduring tributes to the country. But what happened after he lost office was you had the High Court decision in Wick, which was a narrow 4-3 decision. You had a Howard government which wanted to wind back native title anyway. You had a Senate which was divided that the government didn't control. And God help us, Senator Brian Harradine, the Catholic senator from Tasmania, had the balance of power. Now, the question that arose in that instance was whether or not Harradine had done enough to improve on what Howard had on offer. And I don't think Harradine at this stage would mind my repeating that one night he rang me, he said, look, Frank, there are 5 key points that the Indigenous groups want. I've been to Howard, I've met with him 4 or 5 times, but I think I've been talking to the wrong fella. I said, what do you mean, Brian? He said that Borbidge and Court, the premiers of WA and Queensland, wouldn't let him sign off on it. Now, what Keating never forgave me for was this, Philip. There was then the election in Queensland, and guess what? Borbidge lost, Beattie came in. But very significantly, One Nation won 11 seats in that election. Harradine and I knew that that meant that Howard would never risk a double dissolution election, because One Nation would get up in the Senate. And also, Borbidge had been taken out of the equation. I said to Harradine, go for it. Go for the measures which the National Indigenous Working Group behind the scenes said to you, see if you can get and you'll be doing well. He went for it and he got it. And what happened? Noel Pearson and I came out and praised him for it. Keating went ballistic. And so as a result of that, it was said that I was a meddling priest. Well, as I've said to Paul, I wouldn't change a scintilla of what I said or did, even in hindsight.
Been a rapprochement?
Of sorts. Whenever we've seen each other, we've been gracious to each other. And I remember on the 10th anniversary of Mabo, I wrote the opinion piece in praise of what he'd done with the 1993 Native Title Act. And he was very grateful for that. And I still have the highest regard for the man. And I hope that there can be even further rapprochement down the track.
He wasn't Jesuit educated, was he?
He wasn't, and maybe if he had been, the rapprochement would have come long ago.
Okay.
Adil Arcelwa.
Let's stick with Indigenous issues. Just as the refugee issue has been an agonising one step forward, two steps back thing for decades, the plight of our Indigenous people remains terrible. Do you see any significant signs of improvement?
The only significant signs I see in terms of remote communities are the local initiatives, where the local communities are bringing expertise on board in a cooperative way. Let me give an example. I was up in Darwin the other day for the launch of what was called the Miriam Rose Foundation. Miriam Rose Ungerma, old-time mate of mine. She was the first principal, Aboriginal principal, of a remote community school in Australia. She was then the chair of the Community Council at Daly River. Now, you and listeners, even the atheists amongst you, Philip, will remember the beautiful image that occurred in 1986 when Pope John Paul II went to Alice Springs and he held up the little Aboriginal baby and he was there dressed in the Aboriginal colours. Now, that little Aboriginal baby, 22 years later, committed suicide. And that little Aboriginal baby who committed suicide was Miriam Rose's nephew. She has now set up this foundation to assist children like that in remote communities. The tragedy, as we all acknowledged as we launched this foundation in Darwin the other day with people like Ernest Hunter there, the great psychiatrist from Cairns, and key Aboriginal leaders, Mick Long involved, people like that, you know, really great guys who are there doing what they can. An acknowledgement, we had a Royal Commission of Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. Guess what? Imprisonment rates up. Self-harm rates up. Violence rates up. Suicide rates up. So we are in a dreadful vortex still, but the hope which is there in terms of the engagement in those local communities is the only thing going for them. In terms of the urban situation, I mean, what's the positive? Yes, we now do have an Indigenous middle class, and I think that's a great thing.
If there's been a tension, if there was a tension between you and Keating on Indigenous issues, there are now quite conspicuous fracture lines within the Aboriginal leadership. You've got Noel Pearson and Marcia Langton over there. You've got the more traditional progressives over there, and they don't agree about anything, which confuses would-be white progressives.
It does, Philip, but with respect, those divisions have always been there. It's just now they get far more airplay. In the past, I think where there was so much disempowerment and they were not resourced with a lot of their own strong public advocacy, then basically it tended to be a univocal voice that was put out there. But those divisions always existed on every Aboriginal community I've ever visited.
Okay. It seems to me that Abbott's intentions on Indigenous issues are pretty good.
They are. I mean, the really difficult work, of course, is going to be in terms of the so-called constitutional change. And as ever with constitutional change, it's always the Tories are those who are best positioned to bring it because it needs bipartisan support. And whatever they're prepared to sign on to, you can be pretty sure that Labor will sign on to. But the real art of statesmanship in this is going to be whether or not the bottom line which he draws is adequate for the purposes of the Indigenous leadership. Now, is it simply going to be a matter of what Abbott calls completing the Constitution? Or is it going to be supplementing it with notions to do with anti-discrimination on the basis of race? And that's going to be the very difficult work that needs to be done.
Sitting in my confessional is my favourite Jesuit, Adjunct Professor Frank Brennan, SJAO. And this is LNL on RN. With the wisdom of hindsight, how do you regard the intervention?
Well, I was always a critic of the intervention, Philip. I think a lot of good money was sent in after bad. And basically, I mean, the basic rule has to be, unless you've got local communities with you, then it's just going to be seen to be well-intentioned white fella interference. Now, there have been some improvements, but in terms of long-term stuff, in terms of educational outcomes, health outcomes, I think the jury is still out. And anything that's to be done from here, there's got to be far more involvement of the locals. I always looked, I mean, take an Aboriginal leader like Pat Turner. Pat Turner didn't come down the last year. I mean, she was the CEO of ATSIC, but she retired there to Alice Springs. She could see it firsthand. She was on the national airwaves constantly saying, this just won't work. Why weren't we listening to people like Pat Turner?
Indeed. Okay. Now, let's switch topics. You mentioned the long history of the Jesuits and science. Instead of a dichotomy between science and religion, the Jesuits have from time to time managed to bring them together. The seismic studies in California being a conspicuous case, we have another problem in this country at the moment, and that is we've got some spectacularly anti-scientific views on climate change. One of the leading skeptics about climate change is, of course, Cardinal Pell. But whatever he seems to say, one gets the feeling that, to say the least, Tony Abbott's heart is not in it. How can the Society of Jesus help on this?
How can any of us help on it, Phil? I mean, what you've said is the historical context at a time when, of course, the intellectual leaders of the arts and the sciences were church-connected. Everyone was in Europe in those days. If we fast forward to now, we've still got leaders in the arts and sciences, but many of them, if not most of them, are not church-connected. But the church still has something to contribute, particularly in terms of its theological and philosophical insights. Now, what can we do at the moment? The first rule has to be that you always give the benefit of the doubt to future generations and to the creation, and that we are stewards of creation. And if there be doubt, then you do that which minimizes the risk to creation and to future generations. The big public policy problem, I think, with climate change has been, if I might say so, with respect to the Labor Party, I think that measures were put in place, but with an elevated price on carbon, but with so much compensation paid to so many people in the community, that the constant political message was, look, this is a dreadful challenge which requires a change by the population generally, but don't worry, most of you don't have to change a thing in terms of your lifestyle.
Continue to indulge yourselves.
Indeed. And if we really, as a people, and if as the human population globally, we're going to take seriously that preference which we must show to creation and to future generations, then we would have insisted with ourselves that there actually had to be some pain. The old-time theological notion, Philip, no cheap grace. There was no cheap way of addressing this question. And none of us have had the political leadership to do that.
There is a bit of a problem with you Christians, and that is that the Old Testament gives us a blank check. The world is here for us to pillage, to bend to our will, to do exactly what we want with it. And it's only in comparatively recent times that some theologians have dimly perceived within that Old Testamental text a way out of that humanly dominated view.
True, although I remember I had a wonderful teacher of Old Testament, the late John Scullion, a Jesuit, who was a real expert on the book of Genesis, and he, 30, 40 years ago, was saying that there, embedded in the book of Genesis, was the need for the respect for the stewardship of creation. And yes, we were to get out there and to subdue, but we were to do it as the true stewards, and we had to hand on a world which was better than that which we came into. And I think even the likes of Tim Flannery would sign up to that.
Explain to the listener why Cardinal Pell is not the big cheese in Australian Catholicism. He is not the cardinal of all Australia, is he?
True. The canonical structure of the church is that what you have is a series of dioceses. And the theory is that the bishop of each diocese is what's called the shepherd of the diocese. You might remember recently Francis gave a pretty graphic homily as Pope, where he said that the problem is that the shepherds don't have the smell of the sheep upon them. Now, putting to one side whether or not that might be slightly patronizing to the laity and the rest of us who are not bishops, but basically the idea that in each diocese...
I think it's more patronizing to the sheep.
It may well be. That what you have is the idea that a bishop heads a diocese and a bishop is the teacher. Now, what's evolved over recent years in each country like Australia, for example, is an Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference. But in theological theory, the real teacher is the local bishop. But of course, when all those bishops come together, then they have a bit of clout. It's what's called democracy. And then within that bishops' conference, there's usually someone who's then elected as the president of the bishops' conference. Now, that's separate and apart from the hierarchical structure from Rome, where, yes, generally a country like Australia will have one serving cardinal. and historically the person who's been Archbishop of Sydney has been the Cardinal. So yes, Cardinal Pell is the Archbishop of Sydney. He's the local active cardinal. And yes, he's a cardinal who's had a lot of sway in Rome in recent years.
Explain to me how he can, in fact, give the finger to the Vatican on climate change. The Vatican has not been a denialist outfit on this.
Look, I'm not Cardinal Pell's best apologist, as you know, but he is a man of very robust thought. One of the great things is that we have what I call multiple affiliations. And so he's a man of the church, as am I. He's also a citizen in a robust, pluralistic, democratic society. In terms of issues on climate change and other social justice questions, I don't think it would be a disservice to say that I think Cardinal Pell has shown, particularly with the election of the new Pope, that he is far more accommodating publicly of the social justice agenda than he was previously. Now, in terms of climate change, he's taken a particular interest in that, and I think we just have to acknowledge that within the church there's a room for a legitimacy of different opinions.
Now, Frank, you and I are at very different places on the cosmological spectrum, but over the years our paths have crossed again and again on social justice issues, because I believe I am not, well, let me say this, I'm not a Hitchens atheist or a Dawkins atheist. I've always been rather more sympathetic to the religious impulse because I think I have always understood it.
In fact, I think you've been sympathetic to the better aspects of our religious tradition, if I might put it that way, Philip.
But we have in fact had a pretty good accord on this. But
we're all being mates.
Well, even that. But it does seem to me that the Catholic Church and the Anglicans and the Salvation Army et al. Have been through the most enormous and terrible convulsions over the treatment of the young and the vulnerable over the decades. Now, I must admit, at the time when it was happening, I had a hint of it in that we had a young woman who used to come and help at the house when I lived in Hawthorne. Who told me stories about the way she was being treated by the nuns back in her her orphanage, which I just couldn't credit. And I turned, you know, I couldn't understand it and I didn't follow it up, to my eternal shame. But it is quite extraordinary how, given the opportunity, a wide range of ostensibly good people can in fact so appallingly and with such depravity and such cruelty treat the young.
It is terrific. To start autobiographically, for me as a Jesuit priest, Philip, what's always confounded me is prior to all of the recent calling of inquiries, etc., I had literally only once had a person come to me to talk about sexual abuse that they had suffered within the church. Now, I still to this day don't know what the disconnect was there. Since inquiries have been called, I've had quite a number of people speak to me in a pastoral way about the matter. But I have to admit that, you know, I must have been part of some sort of clerical structure where there was just that disconnect.
We didn't want to think about the unthinkable, and it wasn't forced upon us.
It wasn't, and I suppose if we heard things, you know, second hand or third hand, we had a tendency to say to ourselves, well, if there was anything in that, presumably it's being attended to. Now, the horrific thing for me as a priest and a social justice advocate has been realising that, I mean, I joined the Jesuits in 1975, I was ordained in 1985, that even at the time I was ordained, it would seem that there were instances of this occurring in the Catholic Church at a rate far more exponential than in other equivalent churches. And that's a matter of deep shame. And that basically the structures were such that it probably wasn't until about 1996 that structures that were halfway effective were put in place. Now, that's something which I think is deeply shaming.
I have for years tried to get Gary Wills on the program. He's my favourite American Catholic. Writes dazzlingly on Catholic matters from a very progressive viewpoint.
His latest book is Why Priests.
Why Priests. He argues that the whole structure is redundant and they're not actually in the Constitution. But previously to that, I think he wrote most knowingly, most tellingly, and in some ways most compassionately about the pedophile phenomenon in the church. And he does link it back, as you know, to what he sees as a lack of sexual maturation taking place with priests, who in a sense remain children.
Yeah. I mean, I'm no expert on psychosexual matters, but even before a Royal Commission was called, I was one of the people out there saying, well, look, there's been research done by people like Patrick Parkinson at Sydney University, which would seem to indicate that there's a much greater rate of offence among Catholic clergy than amongst others. And as I said then, this matter requires explanation. Now, my own bit of pop psychology, for what it's worth, is that I do think a number of fellows who come into the Catholic priesthood, particularly at a young age, might have an arrested psychosexual development, and that it's put on hold for years, and then the fact that it seems that the majority of their victims seem to be young boys indicates that we're dealing with a particular cohort of people for whom that development has been difficult.
It reminds me, in fact, of the Michael Jackson phenomenon. One could argue that Michael Jackson wasn't so much a pedophile as a Peter Pan, as a total case of arrested development himself.
Yes, and I think, I mean, from some of the cases I've known, I'd say that is the case. I mean, others, tragically, as we know, Philip, often those who are abusers themselves were abused as young people. Now, it wouldn't be beyond credibility to suggest that some people who have been abused when young, if they have a religious dimension, that they might think to themselves living life as a celibate priest might be the way to go, and that then might play itself out. But, as I say, I'm no expert on these things, and I'm one of those Australians who says, please God, let's hope that this Royal Commission has enough expertise and resources available to it to come up with some of the answers.
We've observed in recent years a great many Catholics around the world, and certainly in Australia, walking away from dogma, walking away from official policy.
Understandably.
And particularly on issues like contraception. Now, we both know it was a close call. There were moments in Catholic history when the Vatican was that close to approving, for example, the pill.
Sure.
Changed its mind. It seems to me, however, that all, you know, that given the global pandemic of AIDS and other problems, that this is still a huge issue for the church. Any sign of it being addressed?
I think there is, I think in two ways. One of the profoundly liberating things for me about Pope Francis is that I think he's put paid, at least for the terms of this papacy, Philip, to all of that old debate about whether or not we respect the formed and informed conscience of the individual. Now, for Catholics like myself, it's that our obligation is to form and inform our conscience into that conscience.
But Pell hates that argument.
No, I think of late there are indications that there's an acknowledgement. I mean, what he hates is the identification of that with, oh, well, you just go out and do your own thing. Now, people like myself have never said that, and that's preposterous. But what's essential is the question, what do we see in the Catholic tradition? It's that we see that there is value in tradition, there's value in authority, because what we see through the ages is reflection on human experience in the light of the scriptures and the church tradition. But what this Pope has done is that he's given us license to look at conscience, but also developments in the world which we might call liberal or humanistic, where under previous popes there was a tendency to say, look, that's something contrary to the church. It's not. It's something which is the action of the Spirit. Now, in terms of dealing now with questions like contraception, basically, as I've often said, you know, I've been a priest now a long time, 28 years. I have never, ever had anyone come to me in confession about contraception. I think in developed countries like Australia, people have made their decisions about these things a long, long time ago. Now, in terms of church policy, with, for example, the availability of condoms with AIDS programs or whatever, let's not forget, the church is one of the major contributors to addressing AIDS in underdeveloped countries. And I think there is room for change, and I think with this papacy it will come.
Let's wind up by looking at just grotty political problems. WikiLeaks, that young bloke is incarcerated or accommodated in Russia at the moment, and the revelations that we've all been tapping everyone else's phones. Now, at the moment, the president of Indonesia is quite miffed that Australia's been listening in. How do you view this sort of stuff?
Well, I've been a bit involved with the Timorese government of late, Philip, once again on their oil and gas. And their line to me was that we Australians were bugging their cabinet room when we were negotiating the CMATS treaty in 2006. Now, I have to confess to being one of those old-time Australians who thought to myself, oh, really? Come on, you Timorese, do you really think that would be true? Well, I have to admit now, it's bloody well obvious. Of course things like this were going on. How does it feel? I mean, imagine if we were told that the Indonesians were taping Jeanette Howard's telephone calls. We'd be outraged. And I'm outraged.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I discovered recently that ASIO opens its file on me when I was 16 years of age, so I'm used to being under surveillance, I guess, but it is extraordinary, isn't it, now with all the new technologies, that there is no privacy, no secrecy, and that what Murdoch does in the UK is echoed by what governments do to each other.
It is, and the question is, what does it do to us in terms of just our natural human intimacies of life? And what does it do to us in terms of our natural means for political engagement? I mean, imagine if it was said that, of course, the phones of every Labor politician will now be tapped by government officials in Canberra, and if need be, there would be the possibility of providing information to the Prime Minister.
I reckon they should be tapping all the Jesuit phones, that's for sure.
Oh, I'm sure they're doing
that. They're part of the global conspiracy.
Well, the good thing about them tapping our phones is they could get some ongoing theological education as well as all the...
And perhaps some good advice on climate change. Look, Frank, lovely to talk to you.
You too, Philip. It was very good of you to call your priest in the last week of liturgical time.
Adjunct Professor Frank Brennan, SJAO. And Frank's CV is daunting and prodigious.